huge news, years in the making, my brand new book that my publishers refuse to publish, Money Matrix. Beat the money system and build generational wealth. Understand the three main ways that the banks productize you and make money from you. You'll be able to turn that system against itself, build generational wealth and multiple streams of recurring income. It's all at moneymatrix.cash. And if you're quick, the first few hundred registrants and buyers will receive many special bonuses from me. The brand new Moneymaker Summit 3-day special event. Meet me at a champagne reception. Meet me at a multi-millionaire networking dinner. Go now, moneymatrix.cash. This is huge.
Welcome to the Disruptive Entrepreneur Podcast.
What does the word disruptive mean to you?
It means going beyond the ordinary, going beyond the status quo.
Not thinking in the conventional way, not just sort of following the herd.
Disruptive means shaking things up, you know?
Disruptive entrepreneur is somebody who sees the problem and embraces the problem with a new way.
Shake up and awakening.
Quality will take care of itself, and you'll go from being disruptive but also profitable.
When you use your own reservoir of talent, when you love what you do, then you disrupt.
Mix it up, change it up, and dominate.
And now, your host, 8 times best-selling author and double world record holder, Rob Moore.
Hi, it's Rob Moore here, and I am with Matt Fidesz. Matt Fidesz in the house now. Matt has an amazing story. I'm sure many people will know of him. And if you don't know of him, you are going to know of him after this interview. Matt and I have become Clubhouse kind of best buddies, really. We're similar age. We've got a similar story and didn't even know of each other until, 2 weeks ago, 1 week ago, Matt, on Clubhouse?
Clubhouse is the thing, man. We just took off. We connected. Great minds come together. Law of attraction, eh?
Amen to that. So, yeah, we message each other every day now. 8-minute long WhatsApp messages. So, Matt, some of my audience may not know you. Now, normally what I don't do on a Disruptive Entrepreneur episode is get someone to tell their full story. I normally like to shake it up a bit. But I think in your instance, we need to make an exception because you have got a crazy story. And I know I ask you to do your intros in 30 seconds on Clubhouse, but I'm going to give you 5 minutes now, Matt, to take us from the journey. Go back to a kid. Take us to how you sort of built your notoriety in your career and obviously what you're really well known for. And I'm just going to sit back and listen. Over to you.
Okay. Well, my name's Matt Fidesz. The martial arts world are going to know me, and the fitness world and some of the business world will know me from TV shows like Rich House, Poor House, and being on This Morning, Good Morning Britain and stuff. But all started off from when I was at school. I wasn't very good at school, Rob. I got bullied. And I just wasn't good at it. I just didn't see any kind of correlation to that making me go on to be successful at all. And no confidence whatsoever. And the child who sat next to me at school, he was doing a martial art called jiu-jitsu at the time. And I was worried about this bully who was constantly a lot bigger than me, same age, a lot bigger than me and so on, which I'll get onto later on. He was doing just petty things like kicking my legs under the table and, you know, chasing around the playground, nicking my milk and stuff like that. But when you're 5, 6 years old, it really does attack you. And I was a skinny little short child. I didn't get bigger until I started doing weight training and training hard when I was older. He just said, kind of come to this martial arts class. And if this kid attacks you, you can defend yourself, you know. So I did. I went on to the class. The first lesson was free. My parents were real against it. They classed martial arts as legalized violence, but they still let me go because they're worried about my safety. I changed schools seven times, I mean, to try and avoid it, but you attract the bullies by the way you are. I did the first martial arts class. Jiu-jitsu was not for me. I didn't like being thrown, Rob. It wasn't for me. I hated that feeling and stuff. And then in the room next door, there was a class going on of a martial art called Taekwondo. And I just took to that. I could already do the splits for some reason. I could already do the high kicks and stuff. And I really loved kicking people in the head. I just did really enjoyed it. It was just fun for me. And I said to my parents, you know, this is what I want to do for a career. And no one had ever done it before, as far as I was aware. I was a school kid. And so I just trained 5 nights a week. The instructor really saw something in me trained at home all the time with read books, Bruce Lee fanatic, Jean-Claude Van Damme and stuff. And just tried to watch all the movies, best of the best. And anything I could, I used to get up early 4 a.m. just to watch these movies before I went to school. I was just a martial arts fanatic. And then when I got to about 13, I was in a maths class and they were teaching me one of the GCSE mock questions, which is how many different ways can you put 50p into a phone box? I just thought it was utterly ridiculous, you know. And actually, when the GCSE exam, I'm not proud of this, by the way, I was a kid back then, question was asked in my actual real exam, it popped up, how many different ways can you put 50p in a phone box? I just put stupid question next to it. So no wonder I failed at all my GCSEs. But what I did do in that maths class that day, do you know, you've got the little exercise books they still use, I guess, today. On the back page, I wrote down the list of goals or things I wanted to do. And it was being able to do some crazy things, being able to do splits on the chairs. Yeah, is a big dream for some martial artists. You regret it when you're 40, when your hips are hurting. Be able to kick the ceiling and stuff like that. But other things I put on there is I want to be the most well-known martial arts instructor in the world, have the biggest martial arts business in the world, be in shape and a bodybuilding standard, you know, and stuff like that. Be a millionaire by the time I was 20. And I listed it. My mum kept it. She kept it. She looked at it. She kind of admired it because she was one of 14 children who all got degrees. Because she had four sons young, my dad worked for the British Rail. He lost his job. She had to be the breadwinner. So my dad became like a house husband with us, for us boys. And she home studied, starting off as a legal executive to become a lawyer. And I really admired that. Well, my memories of her are sitting there with her study books. And she always used to say, because all my family were against it, you can't make any money out of that, especially my grandfather. He only passed away in November, bless him. He was 1997 almost. He took me in his shed and he said, Matthew, you need to get a trade. You need to be a plumber, electrician, because they all worked for British Rail, for Brunel's. It goes back right to my great-great-granddad. So I was either degree side for my mum, uni, or get a trade for my dad's side. And he was trying to, he said, you're never going to make any money out of kicking your legs in the side. Stop this ridiculous stuff. Dad just pushed me even more wrong. I left school, no qualifications. 16. I knew I couldn't do what I wanted to do right then because I felt I was too young. Now, I did some strange things, right? If you look back at my pictures, and the guys who know me will remember these days, I read somewhere that people with long hair, especially men, they look older. So I grew a ponytail, which I look back now and I think, what the heck, you know, a permed hair at some points for fitness videos and stuff and so on. And I got a job and I studied personal training, teaching people how to... Personal trainer. The guy gave me a job in the gym as a personal trainer. I taught women how to lose weight, guys how to gain muscle. Until I was about nearly 17. And then I realized, right, I want to go for this now. I didn't want to do it in my hometown because I have respect for my martial arts instructor. So I moved to a little town called Barnstable. Not very big, 30,000 people in North Devon on the coast. Beautiful place. Everyone was saying it'll never work. It won't work. People down there, they won't take to it. But I thought in my head, if this has never been done before, and people keep saying nothing is ever going to work down there, that concept, then there'd be an opportunity. I just knew there'd be an opportunity there. So I got a job at the local leisure centre as a lifeguard for £2.75 an hour. And I just used that time. Obviously, I did jump in the pool every now and then to pull a child out. I just want to get that in. But most of the time, the pool was empty. You start seeing fish after a while. But I used that time to think out, what can I do here? You know, how can I make this a business? And back then, the mindset was, the higher I can kick, the more students I would attract. The better I could do the splits without warming up even, if cold, the more students I can attract, you know, the more competitions I can win. When in fact, it's not about that at all. Parents are only concerned, what are you going to do for my child? What are you going to do for me to lose weight? You know, that's all they're interested in. They're not interested in what you've done and so forth. So I opened up my first school. It was actually, I kept on putting it off, Rob, and I had a girlfriend at the time, and she, for Christmas, we had nothing. We were in a bed sit, literally, where we changed the sofa to a bed at night and back again. My parents disowned me. They didn't talk to me for a couple of years because of my decision. I wanted to be a martial arts instructor. They thought it was ridiculous. They wanted to be a vet. I love animals, and that's what they wanted me to do. So they cut me off. We had no money other than my £2.75 an hour. And I kept on saying to them, I'm going to open up this school. I'm going to do it. And in the end, on Christmas Day, for Christmas, she got me a briefcase. She goes, you keep saying you're going to do this. Now you're going to have to, because it's what I've got you. And an auntie of mine, she got me a food hamper for Christmas. That's how bad off we were financially. And then I opened up the school in August 97, and I put posters everywhere. My uncle designed me a poster, and I put them everywhere as far as I could see. And I was getting pages back then. There wasn't phone calls, so I'd get a page and I'd ring them back and book them in. I booked all these people in for this class on a Sunday morning. I was all excited. I turned up at the class, ready to teach traditional, how I've been taught, WTF Olympic Taekwondo. Nobody turned up, Rob. No one. I was gutted that my mum, my bullies who were watching me at the time, and everybody, my network and stuff, and that it hadn't worked out. I got home, turned the TV on, and Princess Diana had died. Hence why no one had turned up. Everyone was just fascinated and glued to the television. So at that point, I thought, maybe it's just because of that. Let's try again. So I tried again, and I went the next Sunday, and I had about 90 people there, paying me £3 per class. I was quite happy with that. I could live off that. All I wanted to do, Rob, I didn't want to become a multi-millionaire, famous guy, nothing as such. I was just quite happy to do what I love, my passion for a living, teaching twice a week, £3 per class. Brilliant. Great. Fantastic. More money than I was in at the Leisure Centre. So the next stage, what happened is I had a friend who flew back from America, and he was raging, saying, Matt, you wouldn't believe what's going on in the States. There's guys over there with thousands and thousands of members, and they're multimillionaires. And my first reaction is, that's great, but I don't want to compromise my standard to get money. Money's not the goal here. I still want that standard. And he said, now you've got to get out there. The standards are there. These guys are amazing. They've worked it out. They're like 20 years ahead of us, my friend said. So I saved enough money by doing my martial arts class, charging £3. I used to collect it in the old ice cream containers, Rob, and go to the bank, and they would laugh at me, but they slowly saw it grew. And I opened up the bank account of £100 in it, because back then that was a requirement. But she had faith in me, the bank manager did. She saw my ambition. So I saved enough money, flew out to San Francisco, where there's this martial arts business conference going on. Over 1,000 people there. Great speakers, multimillionaires, and one in particular, I wasn't scared to approach people. One in particular was a very, very wealthy, successful man. I introduced myself. I was 17. He said, listen, bro, if you want to be successful, I so admire your ambition, what you've done. You're so young, and you flew out here, and you walked up to approach me, which not many people do. Follow me for the next week or two and model what I do. What I eat, how I train, go to my classes, write notes, keep taking notes over and over again. Take the stuff back to English. I want nothing from it. If it works, great. Some of the systems and business concepts. I don't know England. If some of it might work, some of it might not. I just admire ambition. So I follow this guy around. He actually takes advice off me now. We're close friends. He's in his 60s now. And the guy was crazy as far as I was concerned, because he was getting up at 4 a.m., going to the gym, doing all the stuff you would now start normal, like the people at the 5 a.m. club and stuff like that, being what he's gratitude for, then his business planning. By midday, most of his, we call it busy work, was out of the way. And then he'd see his family, and then I'd go to his class. I came back with all these notes. I was so motivated, I couldn't sleep, I just wanted to implement this stuff. Now, most of it worked, Rob, but a lot of it didn't. Like the high fives didn't go down well. I tried to enjoy high fives in classes, like, what are you doing? Music on a martial arts lessons is unheard of as well. So I made this adaption. I was the first guy in England to put people onto direct debit. Actually, back then it was standing order for martial arts. Everyone said it'll never work. Now, as soon as I did that, 100 members on a direct debit of an average price of $49 a month, I secured myself residual income. I just taught twice a week, and my overheads were £15 a night. So the rest of the time I just trained and sat on the beach and stuff and things like that. I mean, that was it. And then I got excited and I thought, can I do it again? So I went, there's this building, and I went to the agent. He said, you really trying to make money out of martial arts? But luckily the building was owned by an estate agent, and my mum was a conveyancing lawyer. So there was a connection there. So I said to him, give me 6 months rent free. Just give me a chance. And my mum kind of talked him into it as well, bless her. And he gave me a chance. And I remember on New Year's Eve there, it's right on the square, right in the front high street in Barnstable. I was painting the walls there with my girlfriend at the time. watching all the New Year celebrations going on, thinking, am I doing the right thing? Is I hope this is going to work out, using the little money I'd saved. But the rest is history. I mean, I put all the systems in place when the first to do it. 6 months later, 700 members, average price of a family rate was about £79 a month. Plus with all the other income streams linked to it, like gradings and all the other spin-offs, I was making £80,000 a month. And my overheads were £2,000 or £3,000 a month for expenses. And teaching more classes. I was teaching 25 classes a week back then because I never had any staff. So it's a bit of burnout. And then I went on to expand it to 5 or 6 locations. And then things got very crazy. I still remember to this day how this guy walked in. He asked for me. And by then I had a receptionist then, and I had trainee instructors and so on. And he said, I'm a reporter. I work for a news agency called South West News. And I've been hearing about this guy. I would like to know if Matt would like to have an interview about his life story. And I was like, sure. He wants to talk about the bullied boy. His kids come to the class. So he worked out some figures on the calculator. Then he realized I've done it 5 times in other local towns. And he did an interview with me, just like we're talking about now. Took some pictures. And I said, is it for the local paper? I was excited about that. He said, yeah, well, wherever it may be. I'm going to put it on the wire, he said. Well, 2 days later, I was front page of the Sun newspaper, the Star, the Mail, everything. Bully Boy becomes millionaire, you know. And they had a little cute picture of me when I was young. And then me now, at Ferrari by that point. I know we love Ferraris, me and you.
How old were you when you became a millionaire?
Well, if you're talking about cash in the bank and stuff, by the time I was 20, I was a proper millionaire. Yeah, I mean, the business was worth a million if I wanted to sell it by the time I was, you know, 19 years old. But proper millionaire, where I had like 5 houses at that point as well. So I had a passive income where I didn't have to work anymore.
Hi, it's Rob here, interrupting you with something you may not know about me. I was one of the few people on the planet hand-selected by Facebook to pilot their new supporter program. It's a very small premium model where you can get exclusive content and advance notice or discount of new products and services. So this is what I've done for you. Not only can you get best discounts for any training that we might run, not only do you get notified first of any launches we do, we also do supporter meetups, supporter dinners, supporter WhatsApp groups where you have a deeper community. I do supporter only Ask Me Anythings. I do supporter only content and podcasts. We have a community of 2,500 supporters, and I'd love to give you the chance to be one of those. I believe this is the best supporter program in the whole world. Find me a better one, but I don't think you will. So the link is bit.ly/RobSupporter with a capital R. That's bit.ly/RobSupporter with a capital R. I believe the gap between free content and paid content is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. There's a lot of free content out there that's maybe not that good. And for just a few dollars a month, you can get the best content on business, on entrepreneurship, on starting up, on scaling up, on sales, on marketing, on the mindset of being an entrepreneur. So go to bit.ly/RobSupporter with a capital R right now.
How big did you get the business in the end?
Well, the business went to, at the moment, it's got that particular business, the martial arts, 1,018 locations.
Wow.
That was through franchising. Was through franchising.
Matt, we'll talk about franchising in a bit because I want to hold that. Because I've got lots of entrepreneurs that follow me, and that's a great business model.
Awesome.
Obviously, you're very famous for something else. And I want to talk more about you on this episode because it's you I want to interview. But we can't get away from the fact that what you're really famous for. So can you tell us how that happened?
Yeah. Well, you couldn't make it up, Rob. It's like a fairy tale. That reporter, so the stories went out. On the back of that, I had lots of TV appearances. I don't know if you remember Trisha, Esther Rampton, Kilroy. Yeah. On the back of the newspaper, you normally get invited on TV shows. So I worked all them. Then this phone call came out of the blue from a bodyguard to Yuri Geller saying, Yuri Geller wants to meet you. You know, I only knew him as Bending Spoons, if I'm honest, Rob. But my parents said, you got to go meet this guy. He's got companies all around the world. He's internationally famous. And he lived in Sondern-on-Thames in Reading. He's got a replica of the White House, a very, very successful investor, knows what he's doing. not just a spoon bender. That's just a gimmick to draw people in, basically. And I don't know how he does it, guys. I don't know. I've probably seen it more than most people. He's my best friend. We became close friends. He's godfather to my daughter. I knew he had a lot of famous friends. He used to coach and consult people. And I remember some presidents would ring him and stuff and some pop stars, but I never heard of the name Michael Jackson ever be mentioned at all. Now, this is the crazy thing. So me and my girlfriend went to Wembley Stadium and I stood amongst 80,000 people getting squashed to death, pushed when Michael came on stage. He did eight nights in a row and watched him do his thing. And I was very impressed, but not just by his dance and singing, but by looking at a man. And I was just thinking, I'm trying to be successful financially here. This guy is a multi-billionaire. You know, he's the most famous man in the world. And I'm staring at him thinking, how the? He says, what a story. And I think back then he was about my age, actually, now. And then, I came away from that, loved it. Now, Yuri, on the way home, he called me and he said, how did you get on with the show? Well, I said, Yuri, I thought it was great, you know. And then we had a conversation about it. And I said, I didn't get this hit. The fans, it was screaming so much over it. I didn't really get to hear much of the music, but, you know, I really enjoyed it. And that was it. He didn't say nothing that his best friend was Michael Jackson. I had no idea. So I, about 2 weeks later, I had a phone call at 3 a.m. Now, this is not unusual for Yuri Geller. All successful people work through the night. You're not, I'm like that. And I know you are at times too, very little sleep. I got an idea in my head. I've got to make it happen. So he called about 3 a.m. He said, you've got to come to my house now. If you don't come to my house now, you're going to regret it for the rest of your life. And I said, listen, I got my missus here. What am I going to say to her? You got to tell me why, Yuri. He said, I can't. You got to come in now, get in your car. You'd stop moaning. You got a Ferrari. Get in your car. Drive up to the house. It's early hours of the morning. Now, love you, bye. And I was like, dear me. So I had a bit of a row with my missus at the time. Got in my car. Drove to his house. Took about 3 hours or so. Kept to the speed limit, of course. Got there. Drove down. Gates open to his house. Nothing really suspicious. There was a couple of black SUVs outside. Walk in the house. And this frail man walks up to me. And goes, shakes his, well, he bows first. He goes, like, bows to me like you're doing the martial arts. Put his hand out. I said, hi, I'm Michael Jackson. Nice to meet you, sir. And I'm like, he bowed to me. I know who you are, but what the heck are you doing here? You know, and I only watched him in show a couple of weeks ago. It just turned out that he's a Bruce Lee fanatic. And he wanted to meet Shannon Lee and Linda Lee. And also Yuri wanted to put people in his life that he could trust. And I was already financially independent. He knew I didn't really need anything from Mike. And also Michael had a problem with security. His longtime bodyguards have retired. And the new ones were selling stories and stuff. It cost him a fortune per month to maintain. He just couldn't talk or answer his phone when he was around these people. So we became friends, solid friends. And we would go to cinema together, have curries at Yuri's house, another friend's house. We watched The Matrix together, go to the movies and stuff with my ex-wife and different and the kids. And yeah, we hanged out. And then I just ended up being his kind of informal bodyguard, I guess, and advisor and friend for the final 10 years of his life.
Wow.
Bit weird, isn't it? I guess.
Yeah, just a bit random. So when you say informal, did he hire you as his bodyguard or you just spent 10 years protecting him and being his friend?
He wanted to pay me, but I didn't want to accept his money because I just felt he was a friend first, and everybody who pays in money, the relationship changes. And I had access, I had time on my hands. It wasn't a problem for me to take a couple of weeks out if he was in town or if I had to go to the States to help protect him. Plus, I had access then to a couple of hundred instructors who can help him for free as well. And I think that's why it lasted, Rob, is the fact that I never wanted no money from Mike. He actually cost me money most of the time. And, you know, and that's how the relationship worked, and we became such close buddies. There was no exchange of money. He asked, I declined it, and that's that, you know, and that's why it worked out. And from that, obviously, when you mix someone out in a circle, we don't stop there. So when you're friends with Michael Jackson, everyone wants to be your friend, and you've got access to his inner circle, which you're talking multi-billionaires and the most famous men in the world who became my very close friends and advisors. And that's what made me where I am today. I truly believe that. You always say, Rob.
Right. So, Matt, yeah. Top three things you learned from Michael Jackson and the billionaires. You know, about it could be life, but, you know, obviously we love talking business too.
And what I noticed from them, they don't talk about people and things. They talked about ideas. And it, when we would have dinner, they would talk. It'd be around the table, and I'm wondering how on earth I got here in the first place. But on a Saturday night, they're not watching soap operas and stuff like that. They're networking about how can we make my next billion and next idea. You know, that's the way they works. They keep each other accountable on a high level, very high level. Michael was a pain. I used to think he was a nuisance to me, because he used to ring me when out of the blue, how many new schools you done this month? And I'm like, 4 or 5. And then I'd always throw the question back to people like, how you doing, Mike? So sure, I'm doing great. I've just done an 18 million deal to tour Korea. Mm-hmm. And I used to come off the phone and think, oh man, I need to up my game a bit. But it was just, they don't talk about ideas. There's nothing that cannot be done or reached. It's another thing. And qualifications at school, what I really learned is none of them had any qualifications whatsoever. Now, like going back to Mike, he can't even play an instrument. Michael can't play an instrument. He can do a few bits on the piano and stuff. So we'll talk about him while he's still alive. It's strange, huh? But and all these guys sat around the table, and I'm talking about like the owner of Harrods as well, Mohammed Al-Fayed. I remember being at his house at the dinner table, and we had Daryl Hannah there, the movie star, was there with us at dinner. Michael was sat next to me, you know, doing his usual pranks, throwing grapes at me and things like that. But they just talking about these big things, and I'm there. Whereas my friends were going out and texting me saying, oh, we're going to a club tonight. Do you want to come with us? And I can't text back them saying, oh, I'm sat next to Britney Spears, Daryl Hannah, Michael Jackson, Mohammed Al-Fayed. And they think I'm flipping nuts. So I used to make an excuse. It wasn't until I was sought out in public with him that people really started to get the idea of it. But they're just on a whole different level. They're reading books all the time. That's the other thing. Michael used to read 3 or 4 nonfiction books per week. And they just all very tight in a circle. They keep themselves to themselves. And you don't say where you are. You don't give away things there. The trust issue was really difficult. The trust, even for me, I couldn't say to people what who's doing and so on. And that's the way it worked, you know. And you know, the sad thing with me, Rob, is that I gained a lot of friends when Michael and me become public as friends, you know, and working with him and so on. But when he died, I lost a lot of friends that night. I never heard from him ever again. A lot of family members too, funny enough. Wow. But it's that network of you could achieve anything you want. It doesn't matter what you learn at school. Qualifications don't come into it. And do you know the most important thing is the mindset. You got a poor boy from Gary, Indiana, one of lots of children. I've been to the house, tiny. To 2-bedroom tiny house, all these like 6 bunk beds to get the Jackson 5 in, and his sisters, and he's got an older sister called Rebe too, who's not as famous. All there, and his dad couldn't even afford shoes; had holes in for working in the coal mine, you know, steel mines. And yet, look where he become. He became, even now, he's the biggest earning pop star last year. I think he had over $1.6 billion in debt, and he's not even here. Which is insane. When you hang around people, you're going to pick up their mindset, the way they believe, their gestures, everything. You know, my wife says to me all the time, it's funny because when I see Michael on TV, you got this gesture. You must have got it from him. But and the way he would reply to a question. And even today, I still think about the lessons he's taught me. And it's the thing. I know people, we know the elephant in the room here. He's the most controversial man on earth. He wanted himself to be that. He would always tell me when we're out, I want my life to be the biggest mystery on earth. I want people not to know if I'm gay or straight. I want people to be the most controversial man ever, because that's how I'm going to stay in the media and sell records and stay relevant. Hence the face mask, the tape on his nose, the tape on his fingers and stuff. And he said, if people want to be interested in you, you have to be interested in Matt. You can't just be a boring old singer and stuff. And that was the thing with him. And he had that mastered. You don't get to be the most famous man in the world with no qualifications unless you've studied. And when I met some of his friends, like Stevie Wonder and stuff like that, they knew him when he was a child growing up at Motown. And they said, you know what? Michael was such a pain. He used to say question after question. We used to be so tired of it. How did you do this? And he was absorbing all the information. That's why he wanted to meet Bruce Lee's daughter and his ex-wife. So he wanted to know what Bruce had there to be the most famous martial arts icon ever. And he wanted to learn that and implement it into his life.
Yeah, I was asked when I was being interviewed for Shaq Hussein's podcast, he asked me, what are the commonalities in all the billionaires you've met and interviewed? And there are many, and I won't go into all of them now because obviously this is for you, Matt, this episode. But curiosity is common in all of them. Like when I bring them on my podcast, I'm expecting to interview them and ask all the questions. And they end up interviewing me and asking me the questions. Now, they're a billionaire and I'm not. But, of course, I've got a successful podcast and I'm live streaming it on YouTube. What's the StreamYard thing there? How do you use that? Oh, this new media, this is all really interesting. How many people is this going out to? What platforms is it going on? And they're just so fascinated, every single one. And it sounds like Michael was exactly the same.
He was exactly the same, yeah. He was just, he was on it. He was just on it. Do you know one thing he taught me earlier on? Don't be a follower, be a pioneer. Model, we're all big fans of modeling people. So I modeled the guy in the States, right? The martial arts guy, success millionaire. He said, but model people and then learn from them and then make it better than you've ever done before. And practice, practice, practice. So he would learn from his icons. He used to say, like James Brown, Fred Astaire, Diana Ross. He would model everything they did. If you watch James Brown dancing and watch Mike dance, you'll see some things there. If you watch Mike dance on stage, you see the martial arts are in there. They all the Jackson 5 are trained in martial arts. They did Kung Fu. They all got black belts. Joe Jackson made them do that. Even Mike, you'll see his kicks and his blocks in there and so on. But model people and then build on it and become a pioneer, not a follower. That was Michael's thing. And that was all of his inner circle too. Like Steven Spielberg was one of his close friends, and he always used to say, this is a good movie, but it could have been better. And I tell you what, Rob, if you try and sit down with these guys, I'm sure you have done, and you watch a movie or a documentary, it was irritating because they would like say, that could have been filmed better. They should have shot that from another angle. They should have made this story better by making it more controversial. And I'm like, Mike, will you just shut up so we can just watch this thing? Totally analyze it. And absorb him. He won't read a book unless he learned from it. He won't watch the TV unless he learns. He won't watch the news. He just wanted to know how to take his life to the next level. Unfortunately, if social media was around that now, things might have been a bit different. But with the tabloid media and stuff, you've got to trust journalists to portray you. And if you create yourself as a mystique and you can't put it right unless they do it, then obviously he died in 2009. The world's changed a lot since then. Now he could jump on Clubhouse and kill out rumors and false stories, or he could do a Facebook Live. Back then, we had MySpace, and Michael was just learning how to do emails, but wasn't very good at it. So, it's just a whole new thing. It's all about personal branding. The other main thing I picked up for them too, and I'll quickly go through it, and I'll name some names I think I'm allowed to, okay? So we'll start with Michael, personal branding. How's he done it, Rob? Well, white glove? Why has he only got one white glove? Because you're going to ask, why is Michael only wearing one white glove? Doesn't make any sense. When he's dancing, it's going to draw his attention to all the movement. He's got diamonds all over it and so on. White socks, short trousers. Well, why your trousers are too short, Mike? Why is that? He wants the public asking that. You know, loafers. That's all he used to wear, was those black loafers. The tape on his fingers. I asked him once, Michael, what's wrong? Why are you putting tape on your fingers for? And he said to me, exactly. I want people to ask that question. So I stay relevant and I stay in the media. The other big thing, which is controversial, always, he came out of this hotel room and we're going to a very high-profile business event and he had to close a property deal. And Michael had all this sticky tape all over his nose and he saw I was staring at it and I wasn't too pleased about it. I was a bit concerned. And he said, Matt, don't worry. It's just allergy tape. It's to satisfy the fuzzled dazzle. So I can make the front pages of all the tabloids over the next few days. My nose is not falling off and stuff, but I want them to say that, you know? And then like the face mask now, which is ironic for me because it's like not everyone, even I wear, when I first put one on, I think this is madness, man. I used to walk, say to Michael, if you're going to put that thing on, I'm not walking with you into a bookstore because it's embarrassing, you know? But he put the face mask on because people want to know why and what's he trying to hide behind that? And then he'd used makeup to make himself look worse sometimes or to get in the media, you know, and to try and get the headlines. The first conversation when we got to a new city was, how can I make the media, the front pages? What can we do? What can we do?
Right. Let me ask you this, Matt. Tell us something about Michael that he's very misunderstood about, or maybe no one really knows about him, if you don't mind.
Sure. He was into women. I mean, he loved women. I mean, that's the thing, guys. I mean, I'm sorry. He fooled you. You fell into his trap. That's what he wanted. Unfortunately, and it's backfired because he's not here to speak for himself. And we didn't want to talk about it until last year because that awful documentary came out. And then I decided it's time to speak out. I know he's into women, so I used to sneak them into his room and help protect his image. And he had girlfriends right up to the very end. He didn't want that to be public. Only reason being, Rob, to keep the mystique. And from 5 years old, the first thing you were taught by a record label back then is you're not allowed to have a girlfriend because it will upset your fan base. And he listened to that to them.
Wow.
And that was the reason. And when he would break up from a girl, I remember he was sat next to me in the back of a car and he would like see a girl outside of those hands. Like, oh, gee, I'd love to have her in my room, you know? He was also very respectful too. But when you're as famous as him, it's very hard to meet a girlfriend. But no, he had a regular woman right up to the end of his life and various girlfriends who have, interestingly, written books and spoke to the media. But the media, they say, we know about this, but we don't want to write about it because it doesn't go with the narrative. That was the thing. The other thing too, that documentary last year is full of rubbish. I know those guys. Absolutely. Yeah. One of them has already lost their case too. What they did mention in that documentary is that they're both suing the Jackson State for hundreds of millions of dollars. I mean, that's the narrative of the story. Surely. I think had the public watched that and that came up on the screen, that Wade and James are suing the Michael Jackson estate for hundreds of millions of dollars, they would flick the channel. And that made us very, very, very angry being covered in that piece. You know, so we went on and we did something on Ask the Truth and combated that. But no, it's just coming. Those two guys both gave evidence in this trial in 2005 because they are star witnesses and said they did, you know, he did nothing to them. He was into women. But in America, if you get past 7 years, if you lie on oath, then they can't come back after you. So they waited to 2012. And we got to talk about the other allegation too, Geordie Chandler, which is very famous, 1993. Michael Jackson paid off Geordie Chandler. He was in the middle of a world tour called Dangerous. He had no choice because his insurance company made him. His insurance company paid him. And that's all out there, paperwork documented and so on. Michael wanted to fight it to go to court. But big money in the tours back then, you know, 80,000 people in a stadium times 8 per country around the world. They wanted to get him back out on tour. So they put him in the corner. Just get this behind us. What's 20 million to you? And his insurance can be paid off. He had no choice. It wasn't his decision. He wanted to fight it.
Wow. There you go. So this documentary then, you think it's lies?
I know it's lies. I know it. And why hasn't it been played since, Rob? Where is it? And the four-hour version, I think it's cut down to like, it's like a fraction of that now. Listen, these guys, one of the guys said he was abused by Michael in Neverland at the train station in early 90s. Well, the train station wasn't built until the late 90s. He would have been in his adulthood by then. Well, all we had to do is go back to the architect and get the plan in and the builders, and you can see where it's stamped. He would have been in his an adult life by then. So he can't be abused in the train station that wasn't built. It was absolutely impossible. It was sad with Michael, Rob, because I kind of had the bad 10 years in some ways. There were some good times too, but being the biggest star in the world, you were the biggest target. And he was so nice, so nice. And at the same time, business-wise, very, very clever, but a little bit too trusting because he was always treating people to treat them in every way. He would always remind us when we're in public. When in public, we refer to him as Mr. Jackson, be very respectful. Treat your fans. He said, remember, those fans put me where I am. They made me who I am. Treat them with respect. Even if they get overexcited, please, you know, look after them. And sometimes they would chuck themselves under his car and to try and get to meet him because he would pay for their hospital bills and so on. And at times he would visit them. So he treated everyone with respect. He would call, if he met you, he'd call you sir. And stuff, and I'd never seen anything quite like it, you know. So he didn't assume he was this mega star. He just, to him, he doesn't know any different. He never knew any different. And for me, it was just had I been a success without him in my life? I don't know. I think I would have been successful to a degree, but he taught me how to franchise. When I said I've got 5 martial arts schools and I can't do anything else, he's like, sure you can. You could do franchising. And I said, okay, it's never been done in a martial arts before. He said, yeah, that's exactly why you got to do it. And he taught me how to do it. He introduced me to a franchise lawyer and he kept me accountable. Wow. Yeah.
And now you've got 1,000 and how many?
Got 1,080 in the martial arts and we've got several hundred in Pilates.
Right. Where should we go with this? Yeah, let's talk about you, Matt. How did that documentary coming out affect you? We know how it affected Michael. You know, you've shared your version of that story. But how did it affect you? Did you lose friends? Did people judge you vicariously? Because obviously you were with him for so long.
Well, I'm a director of a huge company linked to educating children. So for me, in 2005, sticking up for Michael, willing to be a witness for him in his trial and speaking out for him, you know, parents back then were like, is this the right thing to do? Now, my PR advisors, most of his friends, his big famous friends, stay the hell out of this because their advisors say, you'll lose this endorsement. I couldn't care less, Rob. That guy's done so much for me. He's been a family friend. My mum died at 56 of breast cancer. He would call her every day and she would say, if it weren't for him pushing me and keeping me inspired and staying positive, then wherever he was in the world, he'd always try and make a phone call to my mother.
So I interviewed a chap called Darren Stanton on my podcast who's watching, and he's like a specialist in lie detecting. And he said he analysed the guys you were talking about on that documentary, and he said he agrees they lied about him.
Without doubt.
There you go. Yeah, so how did it affect you when all this came out? Did you lose friends? Did it affect you, your brand and reputation?
No. I mean, everyone knows I would not be linked to him because I'm linked to this children's massive organisation if I did not know the truth about his sex life, what he was into, who he was as a person. What I did know, though, Rob, is that the image, his personal brand he created had backfired on him and he's not here to defend himself. So it affected me because he was my best friend and I stayed quiet. I wanted to watch it, absorb it. And, yeah, I had some tears. I was upset about it and stuff. And his inner circle in contact with me. What I was waiting for is, I mean, I'm not big famous, right? But he's got some big famous friends out there who can make statements, who know what he's really, really about. And their advisors didn't want them to speak out. I would ring certain Hollywood stars he would hang out with and say, are you going to talk out? Even a member of his family, actually, who's very famous, and say, why aren't you talking out about your brother? Oh, my record company won't allow me to, you know, or my PR company doesn't want me to get to talk about it, you know, and or I lose this deal or this endorsement. Well, for me, I'm not going to let my friend. And so we got to have a mutual friend. So we all got together and we hit out hard, man, at it with the media, TV. We made a documentary on Amazon Prime called Trace the Truth, where we prove things like the train station. We talked about his love life for the first time ever. And we went on the attack and we won. We won it. I mean, that we proved those guys wrong. And James Safechuck's been thrown out of court already for not being adding up. The other guy hasn't got a hope, man. I mean, he's got no hope as far as I'm concerned. Wade performed in Michael's tribute when Michael died. He was on stage as a dancer. The other guy who's accusing him. It was just a very attempt. And it all states back to his image. Unfortunately, when he died, he never got to get across his real image. He tried to, the Martin Bashir documentary. He tried to, but even that guy messed around with the footage and stuff. Mm. It was not supposed to be about his kids and things. It's supposed to be about the music, his dance, his achievements, and clearing up the myths. And we were supposed to get a proof tape. He didn't turn up. And then Martin Bashir, we never heard from him again, you know. And if it weren't for that documentary, I do wonder if he'd still be alive. Michael was trying to clear up his personal facts. He realized people viewed him differently, when in fact he's just doing what he was taught: market, be controversial, stay interesting, people be interested in you, to stay relevant. Madonna does it; she changes her image all the time. It's not uncommon. Yeah. He didn't want to upset the fans. He felt his sex life has got nothing to do with his music and the stage. He didn't want to upset his fans. That's the way Motown taught him at a very young age: don't say about when you're married or got a girlfriend; none of their business. And and he went on to He done some controversial stuff, like buying the Beatles catalogue was controversial, obviously, and he was ruthless in business, extremely ruthless. That he put his glasses on, he just changed. Bang. He was a ruthless man when it comes to business. So I think he got that from his father.
Yeah. Okay. We've got loads of cool comments and questions coming in. It's going a bit wild here. I'm trying to stay up with it. But it is my job also to do challenge as well as support. I've been getting on really well with you, and I think that you're creating a very balanced perspective here. I think that you're being very respectful. There's a couple of people on YouTube are like, get him to prove he was Michael Jackson's bodyguard. Well, I think if you have a look on the internet, you can find that out. But let's play with that for a minute just to prove that we can dance with the critics. Were you really Michael Jackson's bodyguard for 10 years? Someone's asking you to prove it on YouTube. It would be YouTube, by the way.
Yeah, just stick in Matt Finesse, Michael Jackson, YouTube. I mean, there's like hundreds of hours of me and him there. Yeah. In Google. Go to my Instagram. It's like, I mean, come on. The 10-year thing, you got to remember, from 1990 to 2004, we did a lot of public events. And then he had the allegations, 2005, he was stuck in America. Then he went to Bahrain. So I became more of a friend to him and someone he can rely on for the last 4 years of his life. So, yeah, bodyguarding maybe the first 4 or 5 public events. We didn't do any more public events. We went to Earl's Court. But other than that, in the trial, he was looked after the Nation of Islam. I couldn't handle that. I mean, it was the biggest media event ever, 10 times bigger than the O.J. Simpson trial. So that's not for me. I can't use guns and stuff. But no, that's just a ridiculous question. Whoever answered that, I mean, just put it in Google. I mean, dear me, I've been on countless TV programs. They research you, and documentaries have been made about it. Where I'm speakers, they research the hell out of your life. And yeah, what do you think I'm stood around with him for hours on end? But yeah, just put my name in his name into YouTube, and then they'll find out that. So, do you know what it is with that thing? A lot of people don't think he's like a real person. I used to walk down hotel corridors with him. People be checking out, and they bump into him, like, it can't be you. It just can't be. It must be a lookalike. And he's like, well, I got to be somewhere sometime. You know, I'm a real person, you know. And it's like the whole thing about the Queen. She does use the toilet, right? You know, but have to prove anything. I don't have to prove anything, Rob. It's all out there. It's social.
No, you don't. And thanks for answering the question. It's just I always like to bring in a couple of critics because I think we should dance with that and show that we're not scared to embrace that and just pick all the nice comments. I think that's important. So we're going to do a couple of different types of rounds now, Matt. So if you're up for this, one will be a cheeky round, and I'm going to ask you a few cheeky questions. You can decline to answer. We'll see how brave I'm going to be, but I don't think you will. And then what we're going to do towards the end is we're going to do a quick fire round. Now, you can go into some detail if you want, but just to let you know, it's a sort of a quick fire round. I'm getting loads of comments coming in, by the way, so everyone seems to be loving this. Right, so here we go for the cheeky round. What's the biggest fight you've had or security threat around Michael, either or?
Yeah, well, he won, right? He stayed controversial even in death. They fell into his trap. That's what he would say. They fall into my trap. He would love that. He would love the fact that people are still talking about him 10 years after he's died and still can't work him out. He would love that. Oh, and there's other examples too. Simon Cowell. What's he wear? What's his personal brand? Same white shirt, black trousers. You don't see him in any other clothes, right? Ever. Because he understands that. That's the way it's going to be. And then you've got Tony Robbins. What's he known for? Firewall. Uri Geller. Spoon bending. You know, you just got Arnold with the big muscles and the catchphrases. They all had a little twist to them. All the ones have got something niched that's enabled them to get to superstardom. That's what I've noticed.
Okay, great. So what's the biggest fight you've ever had? The biggest scrap you've ever had? You're what, seventh Dan? Biggest fight you've ever had?
Hey, the biggest fight I ever have is in my own mind about what I can achieve. Honestly, it's, you know, can I grow even further the business? Can I make more millions? Can I get my franchises to a bigger level? I'm my own worst competitor, you know, and I have to use my martial arts mindset to get through that, you know, all the time. Can I have more houses? You know, can I do this? Can I achieve the getting the helicopter one day and all that type of stuff? So my biggest competitor is myself, you know.
Have you ever had a proper fight, though? Like, gloves off, not in the, not sparring, proper fight.
No, because martial arts competitions, yeah, when you're younger, but that doesn't count because when they hit you and they point scored, then they pull you away again. That don't really count.
Yeah.
But no, because I didn't go to the nightclubs, Rob. I didn't drink alcohol until I was 27. I never had a normal life, you know, and I'm not going to moan about that. I couldn't go to nightclubs because that was against my inner circle teaching. You do the opposite to what everyone else is doing. That's what they taught me. They would be horrified. It only became apparent to me when I got married at 20, my rehearsal marriage. We're very good friends, me and her now still. I've got three daughters with her. And when I tried to organize my stag do to go out, I realized there was an issue. I haven't got a friend that's normal. It was impossible to organize. It was just literally me and one friend who wasn't famous. Or look, he didn't require all his bodyguards and security around him and so on. So we went bowling together. That was it. I mean, it's I've had a very different life. So now, if I did go to the nightclubs, it's sure as hell I would have got into fights because people found my life strange. I thought it was normal. Now I look back at 41 years old, and I realize why people thought it strange, where you got permed hair, ponytail. We all do silly things. You're in good shape. You've got the baby all on, trying to look cool. You've got the Ferrari driving around the little town. You're the multi-millionaire, and your best mates are Michael Jackson and the most famous people in the world. They cannot relate to you. I get that now. Back then, I thought, why are people treating me like that? Why am I getting so much hate? I don't understand it. I'm such a nice guy. Why are people judging about me, writing on these forums? They've never even met me. If they met me, they'll see, you know, my franchises, they call me the tracksuit millionaire because I'm literally just I'm just tracksuit man. I mean, I'm just a normal guy. I'm still a martial artist at heart. I just love my martial arts and my fitness and stuff. The money came as a byproduct with me, you know, and I just love helping people succeed. I love making millionaires. That's my thing. I love people doing it. And it's not because I want to make the money. I just love it. I can retire and never want to work. Done that when I was early 20s. I tried it. It didn't work out for me. I ended up on antidepressants and sleeping tablets. You know, it didn't work out. I have to be creative. And for me, I enjoy just inspiring and helping other people from my mad, weird story that they can become anything they want to be if they just follow the system, follow the mindset, follow the model, the blueprint. And I've got that. And that's it. So no, I didn't get into the fights because in martial arts, you're taught to avoid the fights.
Yeah.
So, yeah, if I went into a nightclub at 20 years old, having been on TV, someone mentioned here they saw me on TV with him at an event in Exeter, I think. I got him to go to Exeter to do a public – we raised money for HIV and AIDS, a lot of money, over 100,000, I think. And I asked Michael if he would attend, and he attended along with my friend Yuri. Yuri had the football ground at the time, and Michael did a half-an-hour speech. No one thought Michael Jackson was going to come to Exeter. He was in and out of Devon all the time to see me and his family, and his mum stayed at my house and so on. And he turned up, and they couldn't believe it. He did this speech and stuff and things, and it was great. Shane Hibbert. Hey, Shane, nice to see you. One of my friends. He used to train with me when I was 14 years old at a gym in Swindon before the dream happened, to remember that.
Jump in that then. Next question. I got you. So next one is, what's the most opulent thing you saw Michael Jackson buy in one go?
Okay, the truth to this, right? He would do this. I know what you guys are getting at, right? Is he go into a store and he'll go around the store and he'll spend like 5-6 million in an hour. And that's been well on TV shows and stuff. That's why someone's asking the question. What you don't see is he sends most of it back the next day. He's done a deal with a store for promo and to keep up his image. And I think the most... Okay, that's the truth. But on top of that...
We want the truth.
I mean, Michael won't have a problem with me telling you that. So, you know, like the biggest one in the Mike Bashir documentary, he went to Vegas and he went around his store and he said, I'll have this. I don't know if you watched it, Rob. I'll have that one. And they were like, he spent like 10 million or something, but we had to send it all back 2 days later. The one he did for real is due to a time element. He is a great artist. It's probably not very well known about him. He could draw just as well as he could sing. He was phenomenal. And he would have an air bunker where he would go to, and it would be like his meditation time, where he had the airplane bunker locked down, and he had an artist coach with him, and he would draw, and all his pictures are there, and it escapism for him. When we were in London once, he found out there's this shop that specialized in art and he wanted to visit. And I said, Mike, what do you want to do? Do you want me to ask him to shut it down for you? Or do you want to just go for it? You know, sometimes it works out. Sometimes we get ourselves in trouble. We just went for it. We'd shut down off the street. So he said, let's just go for it. So we turned up. We walk into the shop. It's funny. I remember this guy on his mobile phone. He's like, holy, you wouldn't believe it. Just walked past me. And we go into the shop. And he was taking ages browsing through all these books. And this bookshop just specialized on art, unique art. And we had to catch a plane. And I looked at Michael and said, Michael, you know, it's the time we need to get a move on. And he goes, I said, tell them I take it all. I said, what do you mean? And he had a stack of about 7 books so far. He said, how long do we have? 10 minutes now. And he said, I need to take it all. So I'm not going to go up to her and tell her you want to take every book in her shop. He said, oh, I'll do it. He said, he went up to reception and said, hey, could I have all this sent to my ranch, please? I want to take everything. And she had the best business day in her life. And we had to rush off. And it was funny, you know, the stuff went to Neverland. And 2 days later, the lady called me. She managed to track me down from my martial arts schools. And she said, listen, I don't know if you remember me, but Michael Jackson bought my whole shop out the other day. But I've not been paid. And I'm worried I'm going to go broke. And I tried ringing Mike. I couldn't get hold of him. And then I called his PA. I said, is this girl's genuine? He does owe the money. And it's just because of the fans were outside and it just the madness around him. He didn't get around to the other PA paying it. We had to rush off quick. And then she settled the bill. You know, it's ironic, really. She settled the bill. I reassured her, I promise you, you'll get paid. But those books, they just went straight to the ranch. So he did impulsive buy, but he was very clever with his money. Very clever. He was very, very, very smart. He put all his money into music publishing. That was his thing. Buying people's music.
Yeah. Okay. Great. So one more, and then we're going to move into the quick fire round. I've got a call in about 15, 20 minutes, something like that. There's a couple of questions that are on the comments that I'm going to answer. There's one guy that's asked the same question 10 times because he thinks I'm not watching, but I'm trying to listen to you. I'm trying to listen to you as well, Matt, and make sure that I honor the questions that I've already got and you answer that. But I'm going to ask that about the doctor, so don't worry. Right. So, does it annoy you when people only want to talk about Michael Jackson?
When he died, yeah. And I had to have counseling for that. Because when your friend dies, there's a bereavement process. When a superstar friend dies, everywhere you go, his music's playing more than ever before. You're getting offers, you get media attack and write untrue stories about you that are complete nonsense. And they write allegedly, and I can't do nothing. My lawyers can't do anything about it. Even every day I wake up to it. Today I woke up to a Google alert. About a story about me and Michael. No, I don't know anything about it. They just rehashed whatever they want. But now I've learned to respect it. I actually asked my PR company, is there any way that when people write about me, they can talk about me as a business person now still and go back to the martial arts champion, the successful martial arts guy, and not talk about Michael? And then they said, I'm really sorry, Matt. The guy's the biggest star in the world. You're in his shadow. You're going to have to accept for the rest of your life, you'll always be known as Michael Jackson's former bodyguard. Just like Elvis Presley's bodyguard, he's a good friend of mine. He's very successful martial artist. He's always wrote about first line, Elvis Presley's bodyguard. And there's a downside to that and an upside, but I've learned to live with it now.
Yeah.
Every day I get asked about it. In normal times, I go out in the street, people want to talk to me about Michael. Sure.
Well, hopefully you feel I've spoke about you as much as Michael on this interview. And I'm going to be speaking about you for the next 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 fast power round questions. And obviously, since we've got to know each other, we've not really talked about that because, you know, that's an interesting part of your story, but you are Matt, you are not Michael. So this is the quick fire round. So if you could do like a sentence for each one, what drives you?
To leave a legacy for my children, because I believe the world is going to be difficult in the future. And I want my money to be there for them forever. So I've got assets and things in place. So when I die one day, it'll always live and provide for them.
Next then, what's the best advice you ever remember receiving?
Your haters are free publicists. I knew you like that.
Yeah, Grant's been saying that in Clubhouse, hasn't he? I earn more money out of my haters. What's the worst advice you can remember receiving?
Money is the root of all evil. And money don't change your life.
What advice would you give to the 20-year-old self of you that's got all these franchises and classes and is a millionaire?
Don't let your ego go to your head with your top off, with a perm, your pecs, your abs in a Ferrari, driving around a little town in Barnstable, being Mr. Big Shot, because you're going to have a downtime too. Not everything you touch is going to go to gold.
And a different type of question, what advice would you give your older self? Like 60-year-old Matt, what advice would you give your older self?
What advice would I give my older self when I'm 60? I hope that it would be that I've spent just as enough time with my family than I have my kids. And the advice would be to get the balance right. Get the balance right. Okay. I had all the money in the world, Rob. I couldn't save my mum from cancer at 56. Putting your mum on the ground at 56 years old when you're multi-millionaire with powerful friends didn't mean nothing. I couldn't save her, could I? So you got to put things in perspective. Money's great. You arrive at your problems with style and you can help others. That's the great thing about money. Other than that, you've only got the same meal. You've got a roof over the head. The family is what counts. And you learn that. And I hope people listen to this. You'll learn that by hard knocks. It's very hard to teach. And I try and teach my franchise that don't focus on the money, focus on being good, provide a good service. The money is the rewards that come back, points.
Is there one thing that's wrong with the world that you'd like to change?
Yeah, they don't teach you about money. You go to school and you don't learn about money. They teach you the wrong stuff. They teach you to do well, get a job, study hard, get a job, earn money, buy a house, and then retire at 65. And maybe have 10 years of your life to do what you want. That's just messed up. It just doesn't make any sense. And then if you do make a lot messed up with the world, they do anything they can to hate you and try and criticize you. It doesn't make any sense at all. It's bizarre. They need to teach the world about money.
I definitely agree with that. I wrote the book called Money, to teach the world about money. I have a money podcast called Money, to teach the world about money. I have a foundation to help young and underprivileged entrepreneurs start and scale their businesses. The meaningful business that change the world. So we definitely have very similar interests there. Okay. If there's one person alive today that you'd love to see interviewed on a podcast like The Disruptive Entrepreneur, who would it be?
Because I trust you, Rob. If he was alive, it would have to be Michael. Because you'd be able to get the truth out of him, and I wouldn't have to trust some crazy journalist to do it who's probably and hasn't done it.
Oh, I take that as a real compliment. So thank you, Matt, for that. This podcast is called The Disruptive Entrepreneur. What does the word disruptive mean to you?
Going against the grain, doing that others don't, being in that top 3%, 97% of the population work for the top three. Learn how to get in the top 3%. That's what disruption means to me. Do get in there, smash it up, hit the goals, you know? And yeah, it's a wonderful brand, actually. I love the name, Rob. I'm jealous you've got it.
Thank you. So here we go. Matt, did you ever see the doctor that killed Michael?
I spoke to the doctor when he came out of jail, and I heard him out. And of course, I knew the doctor, Conrad Murray. He was nothing more than a family doctor who treated Michael's children for a flu and a common cold would pop by every now and then. He didn't realize when he gave up his four practices as a cardiologist what he was getting into. Now, he was just a fool guy, Rob, and this is an honest podcast. There was never a time in my life, really, when we would be out on the road where there was not a doctor around Michael. And when I'd ask him about it, he would say to me, my body is a machine. My work is all about my body being able to do what it does. And I'm approaching 50 years old. Don't worry about it. It's prescription medicine. It's prescribed to me. It's not hard drugs. He would never touch hard drugs. But we didn't know what was going on in that part of the bedroom with the oxygen and all that crazy stuff. But he was under a lot of pressure. I don't obviously forgive him for what he'd done, but he was just one of many doctors who should be in jail right now. There's a couple of doctors who are still alive, and they know it. One in particular, I was talking to a friend of Michael's last night, who's godfather to Michael's kids. This doctor should be in jail the rest of his life. But the last one, Conrad Murray, is just a family guy, and he was the fool. We call him the fool guy. Michael's inner circle call him.
Yeah. Matt, I've had loads of fun. Loads of fun. We had so many comments. We've even got a spammer on here now. Should we give him a bit of airtime as well? He's spamming every single person saying, text him on WhatsApp and get your $5,000 payment now. We've had it all. This interview has had everything. How Matt became, you know, one of the most famous martial artists in the world, how he built a massive franchise of 1,018 martial arts schools, how he became a millionaire at age 20, how, of course, all the strategies and tactics he learned from Michael, which I think I counted about 7 or 8 and billionaires. We've talked a lot about Michael and, of course, a lot about your own wisdom, Matt. I've had a great time. I hope you have. I hope this is the start of a lot of other things we do together. We better get back on Clubhouse, haven't we?
We better.
Thank you very much, Matt. And Matt, let's put your link as well. So yours is www.mfinnercircle. Is that right?
Innercircle.com
for your webinar. There you go. That's just going up there now as well. So bang. And where can we follow you, Matt? Where do you hang out online? All my followers and listeners, where can they see your content and what you're up to?
Yeah, I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on Instagram, a big official Matt Fidesz. My Facebook page, official Matt Fidesz. And of course, Clubhouse, another interesting one, at Matt Fidesz. The up and coming Clubhouse. And Twitter, at official Matt Fidesz too. So they'll find me. They just whack it in Google. And
okay.
It's
done. And Fidesz is FIDDES for those that don't know you.
Yeah, you got it.
Matt, I've had a lot of fun. I'll chat to you on WhatsApp in a few minutes.
Hey, buddy.
Thanks for joining. I hope you enjoyed it too.
I'll see you on Clubhouse later, no doubt.
Cheers, mate.
Thank you.
See you soon. Bye, everyone. Thanks.